This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
PTB and Pop Experience, step inside if you dare. It is time for another edition of Making Mount Rushmore here on the PTB and Pop Experience. It is episode 25, if you can believe that. We've been through 25 of these. I am your moderator slash host for the episode, Steve Riddle. As most of you heard in the last episode, Annie Atherton had to step away for a bit because of all the commitments he has going on. He has let me step into the moderator chair, so I thank him for that, and I hope I will make him proud and do a good job on the show like he has done. And I've got two great guys here to help me on my maiden voyage. I got a guy returning and a newcomer. I will bring in the newcomer here first. It is Mr. Rocco Martone. Rocco, how are you, sir?
I am very good. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
Glad to be here. It's a great episode for you to jump in on for your first time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lifelong horror fan and love talking horror. I don't get a chance to as often as I would like.
Yeah, it's going to be good. And also joining us, a guy who's been on here a few times before. You can find him on many great shows across the Quadapods. It is Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you, sir?
Hey, good. Thanks for having me, Steve. Good to talk to Rocco again, too. We've got a smaller panel than we often do here on Mount Rushmore, but given our topic, I feel like that's appropriate. You know, horror often doesn't get as big of a budget as other genres. So, two people, I think we're game for the challenge. I'm looking forward to see what we come up with here.
Yeah, I agree. And as the guys have teased, we are talking horror because it is, of course, the month of October and it is the month of Halloween. So figured there was no better topic to talk about than horror films. And we're going to start off here on the A block by talking about horror film icons. These are basically the characters that when you think of horror, they're the first ones to come to mind. They're synonymous with the genre. And there's been many great ones. So we will start off here with Rocco. Give us the first entry in your Mount Rushmore of horror film icons, please.
All right. I'm going to go with Jason Voorhees, my fellow New Jersey resident, Jason Voorhees of the Friday the 13th franchise.
All right. And what about Jason? Do you think makes him worthy of your Mount Rushmore?
I think he's just one of the dudes that I saw first, and he's such a the fact that it's a New Jersey thing also is pretty cool to have. I mean, he's no Toxie, but he also is he's the thing. But just the iconic, the mask, the machete, the movies themselves were always around when I was growing up. They were always on TV in, you know, truncated versions on WPIX in New York and New Jersey, and just there was a lore about them and the woods at night. Anything that takes place in the woods, I'm a big fan of. And the woods at night, especially, you know, nothing really good happens out there. And I always liked the nature of hanging out with the people, like, and then the horror stuff happens, you know. And I think Jason just is, he has made a hockey mask, which is in and of itself an innocuous thing, a terrifying item. You know, you could just see it. And most people, I think, probably think of Jason, not even hockey. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just, you know, the movies, just there's something about a silent person killing you. I think my list actually has a couple of these that just, you know, there's no reason, there's no rhyme. I guess we kind of know, but the people there don't really know initially, but that's kind of my initial thoughts on that.
All right. And Tim, you had him on your list as well.
Yeah. We're one for one here. So the approach that I took with this Mount Rushmore, and this is the approach I take to pretty much all the Mount Rushmores, is to try to get out of my own sort of comfort zone and move away from my own personal favorites, which might be very different from what the sort of cultural consciousness might think and what's really going to be recognized as like a household name, so to speak. So I would say Jason to me has never really been a personal favorite, although it's hard to really be into horror, especially 80s horror, and be of the generation that I am and that I think Rocco is as well, without having been exposed to this character and that series of movies and to have some affection for it, certainly. I think it's really impressive, honestly, that for a character who, I mean, really is nothing more than a killing machine. There's no dimension to him beyond that. You can't really go past the surface with Jason. It speaks pretty highly of him to have made as much of an impact that he has just visually. I mean, he's completely silent, as Rocco pointed out, but still is imbued with like so much personality. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, for a character like that to spawn a, you know, what, 12 plus film series now, if I'm doing my math right and considering remakes and everything else, you're really onto something. So I think he's kind of a no-brainer. No pun intended. He has no brains. But yeah, Rocco now has got me thinking about the possibilities of a Jason versus Toxie crossover. He kind of looks like the Toxic Avenger in some depictions with that mask off. It occurs to me, and I'm like, man, you might be onto something there. That would be pretty awesome.
I did at one point for my band want to make a shirt that said New Jersey Deathmatch, and it was going to recreate. It's copyrighted, by the way. Any spoilers? Okay. It would be recreate the SummerSlam 98 cover. Do you remember the cover with Austin and the Undertaker?
With the buildings and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, and they're swinging, but like, you know, Toxie with his mop and Jason with his machete. And I think that would be an incredible shirt to say like New Jersey Deathmatch.
Awesome.
I mean, much like Toxie too, he does have a tragic backstory. You know, he was wronged. You know, that you kind of forget that by the end because it's not really that important. I guess in Manhattan, you'll see, you know, him as a kid, and they try to get some pathos. But he has a tragic backstory, and that's like, you know, the best villains, right? Always have a reason, you know.
Right, and I really enjoy the setting too, like just the whole Camp Crystal Lake setup. It's just, I don't know, something about teenagers in the 80s getting massacred at a summer camp and all the, you know, the shitty cabins and just the shitty set design and everything. I don't know. It's just got a charm to it.
As someone who never went to summer camp, it makes me go, wow. I mean, I kind of, even though those dudes are getting killed, I kind of feel like I missed out and it seems like something I would have wanted to do.
Kind of same. Yeah. Very funny.
That.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay, so I was just gonna say I also made a list for this show as well, and I had Jason on my list on my Mount Rushmore as well. So we are so it was a clean sweep for him, and wow. I think you guys pretty much said it best on him. So I won't delve any further to that. So Tim, why don't you go ahead and give us another entry on your Mount Rushmore?
I'm sorry. Real quick, I did always like the fact that there is a Voorhees, New Jersey, as well. That I believe CZW back in the day used to do a lot of shows in Voorhees, New Jersey. And you can actually go to the diner that was filmed in the first movie to this day and eat there. And there's a small little memorabilia cabinet. And they never really jumped on board back in the day. But recently they have like a Voorhees burger and like, it's not, if you went there and did not know, you would just be like, oh, there's a cool little memorabilia thing. But knowing when you go there, and there's like a couple burgers that are horror themed, but I don't know, just a little trivia there for you.
Well, that's really cool. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, okay. Now, Tim, you can go ahead and give your next entry on your list.
Sure. So I'll go ahead and spoil my list slightly by saying I went with, two old classics and kind of two new classics to kind of, I guess, split the difference sort of with my Mount Rushmore here. So sticking in the category of new classics here, it's a character who did actually cross over with Jason, that being Freddy Krueger of the Nightmare on Elm Street series. I mean, this was, for me as a kid, getting super into horror, watching films at like an inappropriate young age, and having like one parent at least who was kind of okay with that because she found them harmless enough, and as long as I wasn't showing any signs of emotional trauma, then well, they're just movies, who cares. And that's how I got really into the Nightmare movies. I was just always really fascinated by the Freddy Krueger character, who you want to talk about having personality. Anything that, you know, Jason may be lacking in that department, this guy makes up for in spades. And we also get the not only an iconic character, but iconic performance from, you know, Robert Englund as well throughout this character's entire filmography. Whereas Jason, it's, you know, it's kind of, I know you've got Kane Hodder, but it's sort of, you know, a collection of stuntmen for better or worse. And I don't mean that disparagingly. It's just, there's not like one actor super associated with Jason, whereas Freddy is like, oh yeah, you cannot have anyone other than Robert Englund in that role. And when they tried in that remake, it fell super, super flat. So just great series of movies, great original idea too, where it's, you know, you take these, especially in the decade of the 80s, these slashers, and they're kind of a dime a dozen. They spawn a lot of copycats, and it's admittedly not my own favorite genre for probably not even close, honestly. And I feel somewhat badly having as much sort of overrepresentation of slashers, I feel like, on maybe not this list, but the next list we're going to do, spoilers. But Freddy puts a new spin on that by saying this is someone who is a supernatural menace, for one thing, and stalks you in your dreams. I mean, what is more terrifying than having a nightmare, but having it play out in reality, essentially? Like, whatever happens in your dream, whatever terrible thing you experience, is made manifest on your body physically. It's just so many, such a, again, an original idea, and so many creative sequences, especially in that first film, which I think is the real standout to me, where Freddy just has that real menace to him. And, you know, it's sort of like anything, you get into diminishing returns after that. But I still think that for the most part, all of those movies have something going for them. I'd say at least the first four, there's some differentiation between them, where, you know, that second one has become so famous over the years as like the most mainstream queer horror movie now. When you get into the subtext, you know, the third one gets into the lore of Freddy, which is pretty interesting. The fourth one is almost like a full length, a feature length music video. It's so crazy. And then the fifth kind of, you know, it kind of falls off from there. But I think they maintained a pretty decent standard of quality for what those films are and what they could have been for the better part of their existence. And again, that portrayal by Robert Englund is such an integral part of that. I can remember doing a Freddy costume for Halloween. I've talked about this on other podcasts, and just a really fun character to like cosplay. Like, I mean, whether you're a kid or an adult, I feel like easy to lose yourself into that character because he allows for pretty much anything.
Especially as a kid, the idea of your dreams being menaced is, because mm-hmm. as a kid, you don't know what dreams are. You have no, you know, they're scary as shit, especially bad dreams.
Right.
But now there's something that could get you in your dreams, which is crazy. And Freddy himself was mean.
Yeah.
He was a mean guy, which is like, you
nasty,
don't really get
vulgar.
Yeah, you don't get that. Like, the fact that he's like this, the amount of times he calls people bitches, which is like,
yeah.
It's kind of jarring now to this day to hear when he's like, wow, he really is a jerk. He's mean. He's a bully. You know, like it's tough. And like, part two, when you said that about that, like part two is like body horror when you really
yeah.
watch it.
Oh, yeah.
Losing control of your body and your body's, you know, and it's literally Freddy, you know, manifesting.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in 84, like he was a character where, you know, slashers were like, you know, they were 4 years deep and they were cranking them out so fast that it doesn't sound like a long time for a cycle. But when he came along, it was totally different than what they had been doing and really upped the ante for that kind of thing. And I guess if it's with Last House on the Left, you know, like that was a mean movie, you know, and
ooh,
Freddy
yeah.
was a mean dude. And Wes Craven, I mean, he might be talked about later on my list, but like he reinvented horror like three times in three different decades, you know, and kind of came, you know, Last House was before Texas Chainsaw. That was a dark, mean movie. So, yeah, Freddy, just when I think of him, I just think of a mean guy, and I don't like him.
Yeah,
well, fun to hate.
And yeah. he kills children, which slashers didn't really do that, you know. Like, actual children are being discussed being killed, which you don't really get. You know, I don't think Jason ever killed a child in those movies, you know.
Right. Well, and there was always, like, the rules to the slasher movies in the Friday the 13th movies. You know, if they did drugs, they're going to get killed. If they fuck, they're going to get killed. It's almost like a placing a value judgment on the victims of those films, whereas the Friday the 13th movie, I mean, it's just they are the children of the adult who killed this horrible, you know, awful criminal. And now he's getting revenge, not on them, but on their kids. It's like the most extreme form of punishment and revenge in a really perverted direction.
Yeah, I definitely agree. He was on my Mount Rushmore too. And like everything you guys again said, just he's so memorable, just everything about him, you know, just from his look, the hat, the scarred face, the plaid shirt, the claws on the fingers. And you definitely hit it best, Tim. When you think Freddy Krueger, you think, you know, Robert Englund's performance. And you know, not to put a knock on Jackie Earle Haley, but yeah, that 2009 remake just, I think, did no favors to Freddy. So I think when a lot of people remember Freddy, they'll think of Robert Englund's performance. So definitely agree with you on that one. Go ahead.
The remake took all the fun out of that movie.
Yeah.
Like, it was so dark and depressing, and like they really laid into the child abuse, and like there was just no levity at all, which even in the first, you know, even in the darkest moments of Nightmare, there is levity, and it's just still a fun ride. But man, that sequel was dark.
It's bleak. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny too, like, again, growing up as a kid, watching these movies when I maybe wasn't supposed to, what I was basically always told when it came to horror movies is you can see you can watch this as long as you don't get nightmares. Or if you do get nightmares, you know, don't come getting me up in the middle of the night kind of thing. And I mean, what movie better sort of embodies that concept of you will not only get nightmares, but they are not harmless. And just puts that idea into your head. And I mean, I guess I was lucky in the sense that, you know, even watching these, you know, going to the local video store Friday nights and renting a couple horror movies, staying up late, watching that kind of crap. You know, I didn't get bad dreams, but I don't know. It was always sort of a fear in the back of my mind, like, oh, if I have a nightmare, I'm going to ruin this for myself kind of thing. So I had my own fear going in.
I can remember being shown, like, being scared, and I was shown a behind-the-scenes kind of video about the makeup, and, like, I think my parents thought it would help me take away the veil of the scariness. Uh-huh. But in it, Wes Craven tells a story about he came up with the idea because he looked out his window as a child, and there was just a man in the fedora staring at him from like the ground, and that made it so much worse for me to think about that, like just a man. Like, I mean, to this day sometimes I don't look out the windows in my house because I get a chill up my spine just thinking, like, what the fuck would I do if a dude was just staring at me, man?
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and give my next entry on my list, and I'm going to basically kind of complete the trifecta, because when a lot of people talk about horror icons, they think Freddy Krueger, they think Jason, and then they also think of Michael Myers from Halloween, and he's another one that has a lot of, you know, deep-seated issues. We kind of see his progression throughout throughout all the history of his films, and, you know, another guy with a very recognizable, you know, kind of look, you know, with the William Shatner mask and, you know, the machete and his, you know, his issues with all the, you know, people he encounters in his life. And it's always funny how it's like he's had so many movies, and like the more recent ones have kind of retconned everything and brought it back to the original. And now, of course, we got the new one coming out here this month. I'll be interested to see how his evolution continues throughout this. I know, Tim, you had him as an honorable mention on your list.
I did, and the most honorable of honorable mentions. He's an easy number three for me. Had I not sort of, again, split the difference between new and classic horror icons, I thought, again, in the cultural consciousness, it's probably Jason, Freddy, then Michael. Although I do wonder if, you know, just generationally speaking, people younger than me have more familiarity or would recognize Michael Myers as like a bigger horror icon than maybe a Jason today. Just because, I don't know, when's the last time we had a Jason or Freddy movie? Like 2009, 10? Yeah. You know, like it's been a good 10 plus years.
Well, also in the 2000s, there were Halloween movies coming out. Like,
yeah,
the Busta Rhymes one, H2O came out in 2000, the Busta Rhymes one. And those had much bigger pedigrees than like Jason X did, which came out in 2000. And Freddy was, he disappeared forever, you know, until
he really did.
Was Jason. But I know my wife is a teacher and she teaches elementary school, but those kids know Michael Myers. Like, so
yeah,
I don't know if it was. Yeah, I don't know if it was being around more in the 2000s and having like a Busta Rhymes and Tierra, like famous young people in these movies that I think that maybe did keep him and made him a little more famous than, you know, there's current contemporaneous movies to watch with him in it where there's not that with Freddy and Jason as much.
Right. And they're even sort of late to the party as far as the Halloween movies getting rebooted with, you know, I mean, we've got one coming out later this month, right? So which is a sequel to kind of the reboot they did a couple years ago, which is I guess a sequel to the first one, as if all the other ones didn't I mean, the continuity of that series is nuts, but
yeah, it's a sequel. It's one and then two new ones. Like, they two doesn't exist and nothing else exists.
Which didn't H2O like come in like after the second one and retcon some of the middle? Okay, so
yeah, they just ignored the Thorn conspiracy and all that shit and they just start again with her and then kill her in 5 minutes in the next one, which was one of the worst movies I've ever fucking seen in my entire life.
Yeah, it's so bad. So we've got like three timelines there of Halloween, but in any case, I sort of do question my own lists, but part of that, I mean, it's gonna be unavoidably generationally influenced. So he just didn't make the cut, but I mean, everything he said, yeah, I mean, the absolute cultural icon, Michael Myers. Yeah, I mean, as far as like quality of films, like that original Halloween, you know, from the late, it's hard to believe from the late 70s. I mean, everybody associates these characters as being from the 80s, really, but you know, that's where it got started. Late 70s, those first two movies are just huge. And I, for such a tame movie in terms of just gore, it's not a bloody film by any stretch. So atmospheric, so hypnotic in a way. Just it's a movie that I absolutely have to watch every this time of year at least once. Because it just is so much. It's so immersive to try to revisit just that first film, if nothing else.
And watching it with Joe Bob did it recently, a couple of years ago. And it's a very, you know, just with his information. And it's the perfect Halloween movie. Unfortunately, he's been done dirty, I think, compared to the other guys. Like I said, the Busta Rhymes movie where he's like living in the basement, eating rats. And they really gave a little too much information for him. And then he's getting like, food by Busta Rhymes. Out of all the dudes, you know, he definitely got the short end of the stick in terms of his full biography.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
All right, so we're back around here to Rocco. Go ahead and give us another entry on your Mount Rushmore of horror film icons.
Okay, I'm going to go with a animal. It is Jaws or Bruce or however you want to call it, Jaws. I think he or it, I don't know, the sex of Jaws. I don't know if we ever really figured it out. But I just think it is, it's a perfect movie. It's one of the best movies of all time. And it's, everyone, you know, it ruined people's summers. It ruined pools for me.
Forever in some cases.
Yes, right? Like, I was scared to go in a pool because of Jaws. Like, and, you know, I just think when you think horror and when you think, there is a sound that people know, even if they've never seen Jaws, but they know the theme to Jaws. Mm-hmm. And they will do that anytime they're pretending to sneak up on their friend in a pool or anything. Like, everyone knows the sound to the movie. And it's just, it's a menacing movie. It's terrifying. Well, yeah, what you don't see is, you know, scarier than what you do kind of thing. Once again, a child is murdered. So as a kid, when you're watching it, you're like, woo,
yep.
Kids could go too. And you know what? Like, it's like your dreams are scary too, but like right below your waist in the water is, I don't fucking know. I can't see my feet. Who knows what's down there? And that's always terrifying to me. So I think Jaws definitely needs a place on any kind of horror list. It's funny, as I got older and I kind of was thinking of Jaws, how the hero of the movie is kind of the mayor because he wants to keep the party going. he's like, I know Jaws is killing people, but like, if I was down there for the summer, I'd be real pissed if they closed the beach. So Mayor Larry Vaughn might be the hero of the movie because he's just trying to keep the party going. And if I was a young teen at Amityville, I think I'd really want to do it. But yeah,
it does look like he won re-election. I mean, based on the sequels. So.
Yeah, right. yeah, so I don't know. I think Jaws has to be on the list, and I guess I don't know if that's traditional thinking, but I have another voiceless killer on my list. But maybe there's something about that with me. But yeah, and yeah, just a killing machine. He is Jason. He's the original movie killing machine. So
and no, I think that's. Yeah, I think that's a great pick. I thought about it too. It's like, how sort of non-traditional do I want to get here? But I just love that, yeah, Jaws is absolutely a horror movie. And to say that it isn't is, I think, just being kind of a snob towards horror as a genre to say, oh, it's too good to be a horror movie is basically what you're saying.
It's a monster movie. Just because we know, just because we call it a shark doesn't mean it's not a fucking monster. Like a giant squid, yeah. Oh, that's great. We call it a giant squid, but that's a terrifying creature that is alien in every aspect, other than the fact that we call it something. So, yeah.
I mean, the sequels get, kind of progressively worse, but I have some weird. Steve may know this. I have a kind of some weird affection for the sequels, just for how terrible they get after that second one. Jaws at SeaWorld is quite something. Jaws the Revenge is one of the all-time great bad movies.
That's the great Michael Caine line where he was shooting that instead of Hannah and her sister's Oscar. And
he missed the Jaws Oscars for reshoots. Yeah. Yes.
And they go, have you ever seen Jaws 4? He goes, no, but I've seen the house that it bought. So
there you go.
Part 3 just is like, Part 3 was originally supposed to be a spoof called Jaws 3 People Zero. And it was going to be a Zaz, like Zucker Brothers-esque spoof. Yeah. But then at the last minute, like, I guess Universal was like, fuck, we can't do that. So they just kind of made it a, 3D thing.
They made it an unintentional spoof.
Yeah, right. With the darkest lines around a special effect you've ever seen in your entire life.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Like just literally outlined arms coming at you. But you know, you get a young Dennis Quaid looking great and a young Leah Thompson looking insanely good. And it's got its charms. I mean, seeing SeaWorld now is a fucking horror story in itself, but we don't have to go there. I mean, I wouldn't put this on there, but you can't really mention Jaws and not mention Orca, which is another,
oh, great Jaws ripoff, yeah.
Yeah, like the best Jaws ripoff, literally a serial killer movie, but as a shark, and one of the grossest, most harrowing birthing scenes that ruined my childhood.
Yep.
Ooh. Yeah, so, that's definitely, it's funny, I didn't even think about that at first, but yeah, you're absolutely right. Jaws is definitely a great pick for a horror icon. So yeah, good choice there, Rocco. All right, Tim, why don't you go ahead and give us another entry on your list?
Okay, now here's where we will get into my classics, and I am going to give it to Count Dracula. Okay, so yeah, super, I guess, traditional, as about as down the line as it gets here as far as horror icons. I mean, dating back to, I mean, predating film, honestly, the character does, right? And then you get into certainly the Universal film series. Even if you haven't seen Bela Lugosi's portrayal of Count Dracula, I think it's just one of those things people have absorbed through osmosis. And if not that, I mean, you certainly got coming in the late 50s through the 60s, part of the 70s, you know, Christopher Lee, at least with the visual of Dracula as we kind of think of him today. And I don't know. I just, when you look at like some of the major archetypes of horror, you think, okay, vampires, there should be some representation of vampires, and who is like the king of all vampires in a way that's like, when you think about werewolves, you can't really drill down to any one specific character. I mean, you can, if you're really into the genre, but again, speaking in terms of household names, it's like, who is the representative of vampires in popular culture is Dracula. I suppose you can go back to the 20s with, you know, Nosferatu and Count Orlok. And I mean, but I sort of roll all of that up under Dracula.
Well, fairly or unfairly. Was supposed to be Dracula, but they just couldn't get right to it. So,
yeah. So it kind of turns into this, you know, weird German expressionist film, I guess. But it's all kind of leading to the same iconography at the end of the day. And, I don't know. He's a public domain character, so just represented in multimedia.
It's one of those things too, where it's like Band-Aids, where like I feel like there are people who call it a Dracula.
Uh huh. You know, yeah, vampire, pretty much. You know,
it's like, oh, it's a Dracula coming for me. You know.
Mm-hmm. It's so many portrayals, so many depictions. Like, has never really not been a part of film. For, I mean, even getting into the 90s, I like that, you know, Gary Oldman and Bram Stoker's Dracula. Like, that's the weird movie, but I think kind of sneaky influential too at the same time for the early 90s. And I don't know, it's been a little while since we had a good, like, solid Dracula movie. I feel like we're sort of overdue. But, you know, you can't really go wrong with the character, even if you have never seen a Dracula movie, read the novel, been exposed to any real long-form Dracula media, you can pretty much describe the character, right? So I don't think it gets any more iconic than that. So is he a huge personal favorite? Again, not totally, but got to give him the respect.
Yeah, you can't deny. And also, like, he was, you know, you don't think of it when you see it and think he was sexy. Like, he was a sexual, like, you know, he's seductive and alluring. And it's one of those things, too, where you mentioned that, pat myself on the back. You mentioned, like, the Jaws sound, but, like, the Dracula voice, everyone knows what that is.
Yes.
Even if you've never seen the original Dracula. I mean, so much
everybody
so that,
does
like,
the voice, yeah.
Yeah. Like Peter Steele from Type O Negative, you know, based his whole vocal pattern on Dracula. And I mean, he's a Sesame Street character too, you know, like,
right.
It is a very important thing. I did see a play once, not in person, but like I read about it and saw like a video of like, it was a black and white version where the only thing was that was color was like a red rose on the mantle. Wow. Or like a drop of blood. So it's like, it gives way to like such expressionism and things like that, where plus he's got minions and like whatever Renfield's doing hanging out, like all that stuff's so wild. You can't deny Dracula.
I mean, even like the vampire lore that does not include Dracula pretty much owes a debt to Dracula. I mean, there's just so much, just a glut of vampire crap, for lack of a better word, in popular culture. Whether it includes Dracula or not, I don't think you really have that if not for this character.
And the famous Spanish language version that they shot concurrent with the original, which is such an interesting thing to think of that that exists.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I actually had Dracula as a honorable mention, and again, like you said, he's, you know, he was one of the first, and let's, you know, also not forget he's one of the few you know, horror characters that was actually based, you know, partially inspired by a real person. You know, if you remember, there was the stories that he was inspired by Vlad the Impaler back in the old days. So, you know, there is some historical significance to that as well. So I'm going to go ahead and finish off my list here, and I'm actually going to stay. I actually went old school here as well for my last one, and I end up going with Frankenstein's monster. Again, just such another iconic character in, you know, horror films. You know, you got the, you know, where he's created by Dr. Frankenstein, and he, you know, comes to grips with who he is, and he tries to blend in with society, and he obviously can't, and, you know, he gets, you know, supposedly gets killed off in the end, but then he eventually comes back in The Bride of Frankenstein, and, you know, just such an iconic performance by Boris Karloff with that character. And I think he, you know, you don't see a ton of Frankenstein films here in the most recent years, kind of similar to Dracula, but I think it's partially because, you know, those two Frankenstein films are so beloved. I think a lot of people probably wouldn't want to see them remade, but I think when it comes to great horror icons, Frankenstein's monster definitely belongs up in the pantheon of some of the greatest of all time. And actually, Tim, he was the last entry on your list as well.
Yes, he sure was. I also had Frankenstein's monster. This is one where you can get sort of pedantic and be like, well, who's truly the monster? Is it the creation or the man himself, Dr. Frankenstein? And that's sort of the entire point of the story and the character, right? Is that sometimes the monsters are much closer to home. They're not so different from ourselves. And it's really the intent and the motivation behind what we do that defines our morality. And that's really what the story is about. But as far as just being, again, just the representative, the what's most memorable coming out of that tale, it's the titular creation, Frankenstein's monster, the modern Prometheus, I guess. Almost a early body horror entry, right? I mean, we talked about, we touched on that a little bit with, you know, Nightmare 2, but just this collection of parts, just a giant mountain of flesh and instinct really brought to life. Really kind of a very macabre concept. That first film also breaking some pretty major taboos. Again, we're killing a kid, and, you know, that's pretty like intense for you know, just getting out of the silent era, basically. It's like, holy shit. But that, just as a companion to Dracula, you know, the Universal series, and then just carrying on through the 50s and 60s, and you know, kind of stalls out in the same way. Yeah, you're right, Steve. I'm thinking every now and then I feel like I slip into a fever dream and remember that there's that Kenneth Branagh, Robert De Niro. Yeah, from the 90s, and wasn't he in Van Helsing also?
Yeah,
which was like what, 2004, so that's a long time ago. So
well, there was, yeah, there was one a few years ago with I think it was Aaron Eckhart. It was like Frankenstein was a detective, like it was like he became, yeah, like civilized, and yeah, it just, Yeah, that I remember that movie bombing really bad. So
I vaguely remember that. Yeah,
there's a movie called Depraved, which Larry Fessenden, who's like an underground New York filmmaker, did. It was kind of a guy who came home from the war, and they kind of built him back together. And you got to figure out like any kind of Frankenstein. I mean, I have Frankenstein on our next list, so I guess I could talk about it now. But the idea of like even like everything from A Pet Cemetery is still like bringing back the dead. You know, that's still all based on the Frankenstein idea of resurrecting, creating life, and, you know, how you shouldn't be doing like necromancy and things like that. But it's funny to think of like A Pet Cemetery, which literally had Fred Gwynn of the Munsters in it being another a vampire kind of analogy. But
that's funny, yeah.
But yeah, he's a very cool creature, and funny that he could be funny, and I think a lot of movies owe a debt to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Rocco, you're the only one left that still has entries on your list. So why don't you go ahead and give us the next entry on yours?
Oh, okay. I'm going classic again. Creature from the Black Lagoon. One of my all-time favorite movies in general, but my favorite Universal movie creature. And I think it's an odd thing we were talking about Dracula being sexy, but I have actually known multiple women who have said that the creature is a very sexy character, and the seduction dance underneath the water is such an iconic scene that, the Rico Browning, like the way that suit is, it's such an iconic image. And it kind of came at the end of the Universal Monster run in the 50s. He was the last one. But he was the best one because he's expressive, he is mysterious, and you could root for him. You know, you don't want these people should not be in his thing, in his land. This is his spot, and we're there, and we're fucking around with the stuff, and then he falls in love. You know, it's a tale as old as time. It's Beauty and the Beast. You know, literally,
it's true.
A Beauty and the Beast story, and I just love it. I was obsessed with my old toy. I don't know if any of you guys had those Universal Monster toys when you were kids that glow in the dark. I love that guy. And I just think it's a perfect creature design. And it's a beautiful story. And I think he's my Universal guy. And I love any aquatic based horror kind of thing. So, and it's just a beautiful movie to look at. If you ever
I was about to say I had him at Gillman, so to speak, as an honorable mention. Just such an artistic film. Gorgeous.
And one of the only Universal Monsters that is in a original creation. Like if you think of like a Monster Squad, like it's not the Gillman. They had to make a different creature from the Black Lagoon because he's not a public domain character.
Public domain existed. Character. True.
Yeah. Yep. So like he is an original Universal Monster. He's not they made that. That is exclusive to that. The sea monster who comes out, the humanoid shaped sea monster.
You know, that movie Monster Squad is kind of a good litmus test for this sort of effort, I think. Cause it's like, if somebody makes the cut in that movie, you know, like they're a classic. Like I feel like if they were in Monster Squad, they could potentially make your Mount Rushmore, and there's nothing blasphemous about it. So, such an awesome character, creature design. Really, like you said, a weirdly romantic film and a such an artistic film. Also, seems like maybe Guillermo del Toro would agree with the kind of the modern spin on it in The Shape of Water, which I like that movie a lot. I know that mixed feelings abound when it comes to that, but I think that's a super awesome movie.
He couldn't make his own creature, so he made his own creature. Pretty much just said, they won't give me the money to make Creature from the Black Lagoon, I'll just do my own.
It would have been interesting to see like Hammer do their spin on this the way they
that's
the
awesome.
Others, you know, and we never got that past he didn't make it out of the 50s, did he, really, as far as just the Universal movies?
He was
that's
done.
Where it stopped. Yeah,
he's kind of a good segue to the 50s. You know, once the 50s came, it was very much, you know, atomic horror, nuclear horror, aliens.
Yeah.
You know? So, like, he kind of is an interesting
bridging that gap from the classics to the Cold War panic.
Yeah, nuclear panic. Yeah. Very well put.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, okay, Rocco, go ahead and wrap up your list.
All right. I have one more. This one might be a little, but I wanted to get a little feminine representation and represent one of my all-time favorites again that I say about every movie I'm talking about, but they are all on the top of the list. And I'm going to go with Angela from Sleepaway Camp.
Ooh, wow.
Interesting pick.
I wondered if you would do something like this. And just the little side chat we had going. And I'm sort of glad you did. I was kind of looking for more representation also outside of just pretty much all dudes, if you can call some of these monsters even men after a certain point. But I wasn't really coming up with any that I felt strongly enough about. But that's pretty cool. Like, I don't know, like, not everybody has seen Sleepaway Camp, but if you have, boy, is that a memorable movie.
Yeah, I was vacillating between her and Carrie White, and I feel like Carrie White probably should be on the list, but if it's my personal one, I definitely would go with Sleepaway Camp. But yeah, I mean, Carrie White, there's not a lot of these people out of, you know, there's not a lot, you know, to choose from. But yeah, I love Sleepaway Camp. I think it's a great movie. I think it's an incredible performance. Once again, it's a tragic figure, a misunderstood figure. She is righting the wrong. She is not just killing innocents. And well, actually, yeah, that's not true. She does kill some kids in sleeping bags, but they were laughing. They did laugh at her when she got pushed into the water by the mean girl. So, you know,
right. We have more moral judgments here.
Yeah.
Value judgments.
Well, yeah. Sometimes you got to learn lessons the hard way. Right. But yeah, I love that movie. I love that performance. I think Felissa Rose, the fact that she was like 13 is incredible in that movie without talking very much. And it's a great movie, great performance, and just an iconic, like, twist ending, you know, the original, like, that's a twist.
It's a hell of a twist. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. I want to give a little love to something I love that much. So,
spawned a franchise. Which I don't know that I've seen any beyond the original, but there are a series of Sleepaway Camp movies.
Yeah, she does not come back until the fourth one.
Wow. But,
the second and third ones is a different. It's Bruce Springsteen's sister actually plays her character in parts 2 and 3, and parts 2 and 3 are almost more spoof-ish.
Mm-hmm.
But they have their own merits as well, but she's incredible, and you can't beat that movie.
Yeah, I had Elvira as an honorable mention, but it's sort of like, again, more in the realm of kind of spoofy horror comedy. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but also, you know, as much a real life person as a film character these days, I feel, God bless her. But, that was, again, honorable mention there, just for the sake of, boy, it'd be nice if we had some better representation, because all of my honorable mentions are more just like, you know, I've got the Wolfman, like you said, Creature from Black Lagoon, Invisible Man, Dr. Jekyll / Mr. Hyde, Leatherface, Chucky, Pinhead, Dr. Lecter, Candyman, Ghostface Killer, you know, those are sort of in the realm of what we're talking about. But
I thought of May from a more current movie. Do you remember? I don't know if you've ever seen the movie May.
I don't think I have, but it sounds vaguely familiar.
And it's an incredible movie that actually does have a little Frankenstein-esque parts to it, about a girl who decides she does not have friends, so she will make her own friend.
Oh, wow.
And it's an incredible movie. Very early Anna Faris role. I don't know. I highly recommended it. Movie. She's an incredible character in that. Should I just bang through my honorable mentions, too, since Tim just did? Or?
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, I was thinking, for a hero would be like a Loomis could obviously be on there as an icon. Gizmo is an incredible character as a hero, and could, you know, get him, feed him after midnight and he's a villain. But King Kong, I don't know if you really count those as horror. Toxie would have been on mine. The Santo, Blue Demon from those Mexican horror movies, you know, deserve a little bit of recognition as things. Carol Ann from Poltergeist, I think, or maybe even Zelda. Like, but I had a thought when I thought of Dr. Giggles, like, who do you think would should have been more of an icon? Like, I think that the Dr. Giggles movies could have carried on and been a different thing, but there's like, if they only had one movie, it's kind of hard to be an icon. And
yeah.
Also, Hannibal Lecter should also be on that list as well.
Yep. Got him.
Yeah, so, yeah, I have a couple of, most of the ones I had, Tim actually took. I had Chucky, Jigsaw, Pinhead, Wolfman. Actually, one more that I don't think either of us mentioned, any of us mentioned yet, the Alien from the Alien films.
Oh,
yeah.
Another great iconic figure there, you know, just such a great, you know, design, and just such really good stuff with that, so... All right, guys, that was a really fun first half. Went through a lot of great characters there. We are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to flip the script and talk about horror film franchises with Tim Capel and Rocco Martone. I am Steve Riddle. This is Making Mount Rushmore, and we will be right back. And we're back on Making Mount Rushmore here on the PTVN Pop Experience. I am Steve Riddle, along with Tim Capel and Rocco Martone. We are talking horror films. We just talked about some of the greatest icons in horror films. Now we are going to talk about franchises. Basically, these are horror films where there's been multiple releases of them, whether it be sequels, prequels, reboots, anything you can think of. As long as there's been at least two or more films, it's reconstituted as a franchise. So I'm going to kick off this list here, and I'm actually going to go old school on this one. And I'm going to mention the classic Universal Monsters franchise from back in the '30s and the '40s. Of course, these include your Draculas, your Frankenstein films, Wolfman, The Mummy, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Invisible Man. Basically, these were the films that would, in essence, set the template for what horror would become in the later decades. And of course, as we know, Universal has tried to reboot it in the more recent years with the Dark Universal films, but unfortunately, those ones have not taken off as well as I think many had mentioned, probably anticipated. So we'll have to see what the future holds for that, because they actually had some pretty lofty plans for a lot of them. But again, you know, when you talk about some of those early films, they're still highly regarded as not just some of the best horror films of all time, but some of the greatest films of all time. So definitely, I think, merits a spot on the list. And actually, Rocco, you had it on your Mount Rushmore as well.
I had specifically Frankenstein, but I like the idea of just putting them all under one blanket. I think The Invisible Man is very underrated in terms of a performance, even though you don't see him. But
I do,
too. Yeah, like, hey, we were talking body horror as well, and that is a body horror movie. It is literally, you know, the revulsion. Your body is not yours anymore. He doesn't have control of it. But for the idea of old movies and people get, like, a little wishy-washy, scared to watch them because they're whatever. But, like, that movie moves, man. That is a fast movie. The things he's doing are outrageous. If you're, like, there's a lot of subtle, like, I believe that was co-written by a famous screenwriter, or someone punched it up. That was I could be wrong about that. But anyway, it is a funny movie. It is a dark movie, and it's great. If you're going to do Universal Monsters too, I think you always I think you have to put Abbott Costello meet Frankenstein in that as well, which is one of the funniest movies ever, especially in the horror, if you're going to do a horror comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely agree on that. Tim, do you have anything to add on the classic Universal Monsters?
Only that I'm not sure why I didn't include it when I've got Dracula and Frankenstein on my horror icons. I guess maybe I wasn't thinking of it in terms of like one connected franchise, you know what I mean? Because not all of the movies are necessarily connected or taking place within the same, I don't know, film universe, although they do crossovers. It's almost like, in some ways, like Universal to me, like that's what the studio was more so than it was a franchise within the studio, if that makes sense. And I don't know how accurate that statement is, but just within my head, that's kind of how I perceive it. So I was like, I'm not even going to call it a franchise because it's more like a collection of franchises onto themselves.
I agree with you. My initial one was Frankenstein, because I feel like if you're going to look at the quality of these films, like Frankenstein has, the first two are certified classics for different reasons too. Like part mm-hmm. two is, I mean, I think you mentioned how like Freddy 2 is like a very big as a queer horror movie, as is Bride of Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. And what James Whale did with that movie was wild, and so much so that, like I said, it spawned a hilarious movie. If you can almost count Mel Brooks's Young Frankenstein in that, since they shot this on the same sets as Frankenstein. Like the lineage is very strong, and I think Frankenstein it's kind of the template for Marvel, right? Where they had these standalone movies and they started crossing them over and making it an event to have these guys together and battle it out. The monsters battle. I mean, Godzilla did it too, you know, All Monsters Attack, you know, but you know, this was being done in the 30s and 40s. Like, it must have been wild to think of like being a 10-year-old boy and seeing, wait, Frankenstein and Godzilla and Dracula are actually going to fight in this movie. Like, could you imagine thinking how anticipated, how much you would anticipate that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So, Tim, go ahead and give us the first entry on your Mount Rushmore of horror franchises.
Okay. So, I do have The Night of the Living Dead, you know, starting from 1968 film. Again, it's sort of the counterpoint to what I was saying about Dracula, where you have this archetype of horror, this vampires and what's representative of vampires and horror as a cultural figure, it's Dracula. And you don't really have that for zombies, right? There's not like a famous zombie that you can really name, which, I mean, that's sort of the point of the character of the concept, excuse me. But what we do have is this very, very influential film series from George A. Romero. And, you know, even within the Night of the Living Dead series, you've got kind of an installment for each decade in the 60s, you know, the original, which is such a classic, of course. And you go on to Dawn of the Dead in the late 70s and Day of the Dead in the 80s. And God, it's still kind of going to this day. But then they do that thing where the series kind of, well, the rights kind of split, you know, with the Return of the Living Dead springing up out of this as well, which Romero is not associated with. But you do have John Russo, the co-writer of Night of the Living Dead, doing his own sort of spin and his own series, which I would sort of fold that into this franchise. Just it is very different tonally, but just in terms of spinning out of Night of the Living Dead, I think you have to include Return of the Living Dead and its sequels as well, and just all of the, you know, the zombie lore that comes out of this. I mean, we would have no Walking Dead if not for Night of the Living Dead today. It's just, it pretty much created the film genre, if nothing else, of the zombie movie. Not that zombies weren't a thing that existed in pop culture, but this far and away popularized it. So Yeah, I've got to give all due credit to Night of the Living Dead for really what we have today. And I say this as somebody who's kind of over zombies in film. Like, I feel like they've done sort of everything that can be done at this point. It rarely surprises me anymore, and maybe that will change, but I'm sort of in a place where if I see one more zombie movie, it's sort of one too many. But I mean, that all can be traced back to the late 60s here, where this franchise has its roots. So that's going to be my first pick.
All right. And Rocco, you had that on your Mount Rushmore as well.
Yep. Great minds think alike, Tim. The Romero, you know, Tim said it very well. Also, to take the idea of Dawn of the Dead, which it was re-edited by Dario Argento in Italy and released over there as Zombie, and then Zombie 2, which is Zombie by Lucio Fulci, which kind of kicked off an entire Italian splatter film, like craziness that happened over there. So it influential in ways that are, you know, further reaching than even just being here. And it's funny because it's like the first one is very serious, and then the second one literally has like pie fights and fucking it's got a lot of comedy in it. And then the third one is so fucking serious. And I feel like that's the template that like a Walking Dead, I don't really care about for the Walking Dead. I think it's kind of boring and it's not really my thing. It's like, once again, I like a little levity in things I watch at this point in my life. I don't need to watch all the worst things anymore. Well, you know, when I was a teenager, yes, give me Cannibal Holocaust and I spit on your grave. Like at this age, I don't really want to watch that stuff anymore. It doesn't really, I don't need to. I'd kind of want to take back my Cannibal Holocaust and all that shit. I like to scrub my brain of some of these fucking things I got bouncing in my head. I always worry that one day I'm going to be in a coma and I'm going to be like, fuck, why is my brain only thinking of images from Cannibal Holocaust or something like that?
Right.
So I should have looked at more like pictures of flowers and shit. But yeah, like even when you say there is burnout from zombie movies, there are still things that come out. Like there's a movie called Blood Quantum that takes place on a Native American reservation that does a zombie movie in a different way. And there's all these things. It's funny that it lay dormant for so long, and then kind of Land of the Dead, the fourth one would have been the Romero one. And they're all not great. You know, the Diary of the Dead's the found footage one that he did. That's all right. And Survival of the Dead at the end, you know, was a little rough. But like, once again, like in a Wes Craven way where we said that he kind of recreated the thing, like there was a 60s, there was a 70s, and there was an 80s with these zombie films. And, you know, there's so much you could read into them about politics and race and all this crazy shit. And that is the joy of horror, is that it gets to touch on so many levels.
Yeah.
And when it's a massive horde of nameless, faceless things, like you said, there's no famous zombie besides maybe like Bud from Day of the Dead,
Sure. Yeah.
Might be the most famous one. But I, and like you said, Return of the Living Dead, I think, is a fucking stone cold classic. I love that movie.
I do too.
Another movie that terrified the shit out of me as a kid that didn't even realize it was a comedy until I was older. And it is canonical, I think, because they do mention Night of the Living Dead, I believe. They mention there's like a throwaway line to happening.
At least
right?
The first one, right? It's like that's going to be canonical to both. And then they just sort of do their own thing.
And it is cool because, like, once the 2000s came and the zombies were kind of done, like, no one was really talking about them. There was, like, the Return of the Living Dead sequel. Part 3 had come out in the 90s with Melinda Clark from The O.C., which is an interesting take on zombies. And but then, you know, you get 28 Days Later and then Shaun of the Dead kind of sparked by the love of these movies. And then, you know, Romero did Land of the Dead. And then it kind of just – they're just there now. It's been 20 years, and they are just there are kids' books about zombies now, which is wild to think of. That would not have happened if they didn't come back, and you know, he had Land of the Dead. So yeah,
speaking of Marvel, you got Marvel Zombies. We got an episode of What If, an animated show that did a take on Marvel Zombies, which is a horror comic. It's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean. Always Sunny in Philadelphia has an episode where they're pretty much zombies when they go to the old Poyle's wedding, you know.
Yeah, zombies.
Yeah, I agree. I didn't have it on my list, but I definitely agree with you guys. I think it. We talk about zombie films today. They all, I'm sure, they all had to have taken a nod from Night of the Living Dead. So definitely a great inclusion there. So Rocco, go ahead and give us another entry on your list.
All righty. Okay. Well, we talked about it before. So Friday the 13th has got to be on mine. I love, we were talking about we talked about Jason specifically, but when you want to talk about the films, you know, it's cool in that there's like multiple, like you have the first three are one story. Then you have the 4 through 6, which is like the Tommy Jarvis like versions. And then you have 7 and 8, which are kind of standalone. You got the almost kind of Carrie meets Jason, which I like a lot with the dude from Weekend at Bernie's, you know, Manhattan. Mm-hmm. Oof, that one's a little rough, but you know, I think if Part 9 was not called a Jason movie, it would be a horror classic, but the fact that it was Jason and everyone kind of shit on it because he's not really wearing the mask and all that stuff. And then 10, you know, he's out there in space, and I think that's kind of fun. But once again, I love the movies. I love the tone of them. I love just being outside with the characters at the camp. And I don't think there's really a bad one in terms, you know, these are subject to terms, but The 4 through 6 is really like a solid 3 fun movies where he gets killed in part 4 and you get the Corey Feldman stuff. Part 5, I know everyone shits on it because he's not in it, but they were trying to be true to the fact that he was dead. So how do you do that?
It's a good fake out. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned Larry Vaughn being the hero. I mean, the hero of that movie is that greaser dude who fucking axes that kid with the chocolate over his goddamn face. Grossed me the fuck out. I was so happy when he did that. But, you know, his dad Roy has to come and kill people for that. And that's a super sleazy movie. And then you get part 6 when Jason comes back. And I think that's a fucking great movie. I think it's got meta moments. It's kind of a Frankenstein story. He gets resurrected. But it is like it opens with a James Bond parody, like, you know what you're in for. Mm-hmm. And it's a quietly very funny movie. I think Tom McLaughlin knew what he was doing and really made the most fun Jason movie that there is. I love the series so goddamn much. And it did spawn a TV show, which is cool. Freddy did too, but you know,
that's
Friday
true.
Friday the 13th did not have Jason in it, except for there was one episode where one of the items in the store was a Jason's hockey mask, I believe. So, but
yeah. Love it. Well, I had it too. It's kind of hard to include Jason himself as an icon without including his franchise. But, you know, even beyond Jason, you can, like you said, you get the fake out in 5, so it looks like technically he's not in that one. Of course, he's not in the first one, it's the mom. And the meta element that you mentioned in 6, I think kind of, you kind of see that also in part 9, which, you know, again, if it wasn't a Jason movie, would be a really interesting standalone horror film where it's like the beginning, it's a total setup with the FBI being after him.
Oh my god,
and they blow him up, and then it just turns into its own thing. Like,
it's pretty wild when you think too that he does not become Jason till part 3. About halfway through is when he becomes the iconic character,
when he dons the hockey mask. Yeah, it was a very you can't, and it just goes to show you can't really plan these things, right? It has to be that sort of organic progression where it's like, okay, we're doing a sequel to this Friday the 13th movie because it was such a hit. We killed the mom, but, you know, maybe the kid who drowned is somehow still alive, and we're going to do that, kill him at the end of it. But in part 3, it's like, instead of doing another killer, this is where we get the finally get the iconic depiction of Jason. And to think that it took 3 movies to get there is pretty hard to believe, whereas you have somebody like Freddy who's fully formed from the jump.
And it's crazy because there was, when you would get a glimpse of his face, it was such a big deal, like, my god, you got to see his face. Like, that was crazy. That they would tease it a little bit. There's that one, I think it's 3, where that's kind of a weird part where he's almost kind of assaulting that girl in the flashback.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of anachronistic to him, but that's okay. I mean, whatever. They didn't plan on making a 10-movie series.
Yeah, they didn't know what the character was at that point. So
yeah, they were just going. But there's so many weird little moments in these movies that you don't really get. Like you mentioned Freddy series before, and I feel like Freddy's a little, even though there's a lot of jokes, it's very dark to me. It's, you know, it's very much, it takes inside. It's in basements. It's in houses and boiler rooms and stuff. Well, this is more outside and palatial. But you also get these weird little moments of, like, the redneck guy and his wife and his mom screaming, and he's on his motorcycle, and then the Crispin Glover dancing with
memorable in its own right. Yes
and then I believe in the Manhattan you get that punk girl dancing as well. A lot of good dancing scenes in this, and the karate with the dude with the enchiladas and all this.
You the get boxer
the, yeah, and then, you know, yes and then you know, the sleeping bag death, which is one of the most wild things ever, so much so they had to reference it. Like, there's just little nuances in the Friday films that I just love. And you get to see, like, it's a time capsule to a time that, you know, I don't know.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
It's fun to watch without, if you took away the murders, like, I'd still enjoy watching them just kind of hang out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a, because think of, like, how often they would show these movies just on, like, USA on a Friday the 13th, just do like a marathon of them, you know, in the 90s or something, or however many they had the rights to. And it's like, they're going to cut out like a lot of the gore when it's just on basic cable, but you would still have fun watching those movies. At least I did, you know, growing up, just as an experience.
You don't need to see a makeup effect to enjoy the story. You know, the story is it's the story. It's the vibe, you know, like, yeah, like you miss a couple seconds, but yeah, it doesn't really affect it.
No.
I once worked at a Barnes and Noble and Kane Hodder came and bought stuff from me. I was kind of starstruck. So yeah. I forgot to put something in his bag that he paid for.
Oh, shit.
And I was like, fuck, man, I just fucking stole a book from Jason.
It was a lowest. Do you know if he came back for it?
Maybe I was after my shift or something, but, you know, I just kind of, there was a Chiller Theater. Chiller Theater was literally down the street from where I was in New Jersey. So he was definitely signing there and had came and bought a bunch of books. And he's a giant man, and I recognized him. And yeah, so yeah. I was going to my car that night wondering if I would hear the famous music.
I love that you botched his transaction.
Oh, I fucked it up. I was just yakking his ear off, and he had like a Lois Duncan novel, I remember it's very specifically, that I did not put in his bag. And I was just like, what an asshole. He was also with a beautiful woman, so I was just distracted on all levels.
Wow.
Yeah. I had a Friday the 13th on my Mount Rushmore as well, and pretty much you guys summed it up. It's, you know, just such a great, you know, great series, you know, all the different, you know, films that have been out, and just seeing the constant evolution of the character is just definitely one of the greatest of all time. So I'm going to go ahead and give my next entry and
the best of all the in space movies, if you ask me.
Probably so. Yeah, there's some great kills in that, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Well,
and there's a dinosaur too. So.
Yes.
Sorry, Steve.
No, that's okay. So I'm going to give the next entry on my list, and I'm going with might as well go with A Nightmare on Elm Street. Obviously, if we're talking about Freddy Krueger and the icons, we got to mention the films themselves. And again, not as many films as some of the other franchises like Friday the 13th, but they definitely made each one count, especially when it came to, you know, building up Freddy's backstory and seeing him, you know, kill all these different different people. And then, like you said, we mentioned it briefly in 03 when they actually had him face Jason, kind of a cool little like horror face off there between two of the, you know, super heavyweights of the horror world at that time. And then, you know, like I said, the 2010 remake, which kind of did, I think, a little bit of damage to the character to the point that we haven't seen him on the big screen to this point. But if you ask a lot of people, especially those that did grow up in the 80s, they will definitely say that Nightmare on Elm Street was one of the preeminent horror franchises of all time, in my opinion. And I know, Tim, you had that on your list as well, so I'm sure you would agree.
Yep. And here again, it's like, this is getting very slasher heavy for me, I feel like. I'll just go ahead and say Night of the Living Dead is my only horror franchise that isn't a slasher on this Mount Rushmore for me. But that's just kind of how it works out. I think that the general public, just from a box office standpoint, is going to respond more to slasher films when it comes to horror. That's just what they're designed for, mass appeal and mass destruction. So Nightmare on Elm Street, of course, has that in spades. I think it is a lot more creative, as I've mentioned previously in talking about Freddy, far more creative than your run-of-the-mill slasher. Rocco mentioned how kind of claustrophobic a lot of those movies are. I think that's a great point. You know, a lot of boiler rooms, a lot of action taking place in abandoned warehouses and bedrooms, and it's just very confined spaces. And I think that just adds to how invasive of a character Freddy is, and just how invasive of a concept it is that he's, you know, entering your dreams to kill you. Just, you know, that the way that that these films are sort of staged adds a lot to that. That's like a recurring theme throughout all of them, I feel like, is sort of different as each movie is, which I've already kind of touched upon. So I really, you want to talk about meta, I really enjoy that reinvention they did in Wes Craven's New Nightmare, you know, in 94, after we sort of put the initial main film series behind us, and somehow we're going to still have this character now reinvented, but played by the same performer, because why mess with a good thing and just put a whole new spin on it. I thought that worked really well in kind of a way that was sort of setting the stage for Scream, very prototypical, and just how meta it was, and just it has its footing in, you know, this established franchise. Would have been neat to see them do more with that, just the new Nightmare universe. But anyway, I think I said my piece on this.
With the nature of how Freddy kills, it gave that, compared to the other franchises, a gross out factor too, where it was like the heroin needle oozing arms and the chest of souls and the goddamn the fucking vein puppet.
Vein puppet, yeah.
Oh my god, dude, that was terrible. And the cockroach arm, like there was a gross out factor to it that you didn't really get like an adjacent type thing.
Even in the fifth one, which, you know, kind of sucks, the guy like merging with his motorcycle or whatever.
Holy shit,
super gross. Yeah,
and like you said, like the claustrophobic nature and the sound of Freddy movies are, I remember like an uncle telling me I had to leave the room because they were watching it, so I had to just play with my toys in the next room over and only listen, which was way worse.
Yeah. Yeah,
because I was just imagining, because I could just hear it, and there's, you know, the 1-2 Freddy coming for you song, which is in itself is just scary, and the music they use, and there's so much the fingers on the metal, and just the sounds of a boiler room, like these are all not natural, like these are, it's claustrophobic, when you say claustrophobic, but it's like cacophonous, but just like assault on your ear holes when you're like sitting there listening. So yeah, it's its own beast, and yeah, it's a fucking classics, man. And as a kid, I think you always liked the idea of booby traps, and that was a big thing. True. Like the first one where she's outsmarting him, like she's setting these booby traps, which is something Wes Craven does a lot. Definitely some People Under the Stairs has that, Last House has that. You know, he seems to like that sort of thing, and I do like it's interesting that has so many more celebrity kind of people showing up in it. So there's a pop culture aspect to enjoying the older ones too. And I'm not just talking about like Seth Green getting smashed Breckenmeyer, sorry. And but you know, it's just like all the little characters that show up in there, and worst remake, but great series.
Yeah.
Well, of course you had in the first one that a very young Johnny Depp as one of the first kills. So you always have that as well. So
then you get like Arquette and Yaphet Kotto, and you know, all sorts of people. It's a Once again, and the Freddy the TV show was a very interesting TV show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I had you got me thinking about video games now too, and you know, Nightmare had that one for NES that I don't remember that well, but now I'm thinking of the Friday the 13th game for NES, which scared the piss out of me as a kid.
Dude, you go into that room that Jason's in, that holy shit.
Yeah, he just pops out on you. Oh, my God.
You know, for the longest time, I just thought I was stupid because I did not understand how hard these Nintendo games were.
Yeah. Like, oh, God, it was punishing.
Yeah, and that game in particular. But then you get, like, you know, Castlevania and Ninja Gaiden, like, yeah, all these games, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I'm like, am I just a dumb person?
Double Dragon, yeah.
Yeah, and then as I got older, I'm like, oh, no, these games were impossibly hard, and, like, there's shit in, like, the Friday the 13th game that, like, no, you don't do these things. Like, you're just, I don't know, yes. Mm-hmm. Scary game, impossibly hard.
Not a very good game, but a game that's good at being scary, which a lot of video games that are supposed to be scary are not good at.
Yeah, good point.
All right. Well, Tim, you've got one entry left on your Mount Rushmore. Why don't you go ahead and give it to us?
Okay. So here's where I actually did give the nod to Halloween. So, you know, 3/4 of my list here are slashers. I'm like, you know, I wish I could have done better with that. And part of me wants to just, like, kind of swap this out for, again, the Universal Classics, Universal Monsters series. But, the list is the list, so I'll just go with it. I guess I've kind of said my piece in talking about Michael Myers, albeit a honorable mention on my horror icons, but at least we got to put the film series up here because I don't think there was maybe as much competition for the Mount Rushmore franchises as there was horror icons, which, you know, you could go all over the place. We could go all night talking horror icons, franchises. This was a little easier for me. So I said, yeah, we'll go ahead and do Halloween. It really kicked off, you know, that 80s decade of very iconic slashers. I mean, I know it's not the first slasher, but it's sort of like the most famous now of, what we think of as early, and influential slasher movies. And of course, you know, John Carpenter, who was a legend unto himself. I even, you know, I'm one of those people, I like the third one. Similar to Friday the 13th, Final Friday, on its own could be a really cool standalone movie. The fact that they called it a Halloween movie, makes it lose some points for some people. No Michael Myers, but you know, it is what it is. I again just chalk that up to the filmmakers not knowing what the franchise was yet. Is this always going to be a series of Michael Myers movies just because we did him in the first two? Like, no, this could be an anthology, but didn't work so well, so we got to bring him back. I mean, I don't know. I kind of love that type of shit when it happens because it just results in this odd man out type of movie that can be pretty good in its own right.
And how cool would it have been to get a new Halloween anthology like every year? Like if that had succeeded, right? Like that would have been awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and you get into the Thorn trilogy or whatever, which I don't know how I feel about all that, but it is what it is. But aside from Michael, you get other just iconic characters like Dr. Loomis and certainly Jamie Lee Curtis cutting her teeth as a horror icon. Hell, put her on the list, honestly, not just for this, but for all of her contributions to horror. So it's just, you know, it packs in a lot for a series that's really still going strong today. Never been like a big personal favorite, but like I said, I always have to watch that first one this time of year. Usually the second one, but beyond that, I'm kind of like, your mileage may vary, but it is impressive that somehow they're still churning these out.
Yeah, I agree. I had it as an honorable mention. And, you know, like you said, it seems like, you know, almost every decade we've had a Halloween film. And, you know, I know a lot of people, the two Rob Zombie films kind of were hit and miss with people. And I know the one that came out a few years ago was, you know, pretty well liked, which is why we have the new one coming out this month. And then we got another one on the way, I think, next year. And fun fact, actually, that the casino I work at, I actually got to briefly meet John Carpenter's son. So that was a kind of cool little experience. So I got that to hang my head on. Rocco, do you have any other thoughts about the Halloween franchise?
Besides. Hello? Besides the music, which, you know, speaking of John Carpenter's son, I believe his son is in his band that tours around. That's, you know, you can't, once again, talking about iconic sounds, the Halloween theme is the most, maybe, in movies, you know. The first one, you know, you just put that on a fall day and it just feels like Halloween. Like, it just, that's just what it is, you know, it's symbolic of that. And yeah, you guys touched on it greatly. Not the biggest fan of the later ones. Was always a huge fan of Part 3. I never really understood the backlash because I was a kid. I didn't know. I just assumed that was a new, like, I didn't really care. And once again, the idea of putting on a mask and melting your face and turning it into bugs is pretty fucking scary.
Yes.
And the idea that that's like aliens and there's robots, like, that is a wacky fucking movie, man. And you get Tom Atkins like running around bedding women.
Banging every woman. Good sex symbol, Tom Atkins. Yes.
You often wonder, like, if it had been called The Babysitter Murders, like, would it be the classic it is? The idea of just throwing it on, just saying Halloween, like, means it's a Halloween movie.
Yeah. Love it. It angers me that I cannot find all of the Halloween films streaming right now. I can with Nightmare and Friday the 13th. I think between Peacock and Hulu, you can watch all those, or I think Nightmares on HBO Max. But either way, those are not hard to run down if you've got at least a few streaming services. But the Halloween films are kind of, I don't know. It's like Stars on Amazon. No, sorry.
I mean, they were all released. Like, I know Part 2 was very hard because that was Paramount that had that. Like Dimension has that one, so those are on Shudder. But yeah, it's got a lot of, it's not like it, like how Friday, you know, is so managed by that, like, Sean Cunningham, and that's what you're saying. There's never going to be a remake because of all that crazy shit that's going on with them. But like, I know the Halloween one, yeah, they're all over the place. I'm not the biggest fan of Part 2. I'm not a big fan of hospital kind of horror kind of things. I'm kind of like Homer Simpson, where I'm only going to a hospital one time in my life and I'm not coming out. So I don't really like seeing things take place in hospitals, but I mean, that movie's, when you talk about how the first one is not very gory, Part 2, holy shit.
Yeah, it makes up for it.
All right. Well, Rocco, go ahead and give us the final entry on your Mount Rushmore.
I went more modern and I wasn't going to plan on it, but I had to go with Scream. You know, kind of took horror from the being a video product and made it go back into the theaters pretty much in the mid-90s, you know. Once again, Wes Craven reinventing the genre for the third decade in a row, and was brutal. I literally just watched it on AMC before we made this call, and yes, it is a very 90s movie. But that said, it's a 90s movie, so that's what you're going to get. But
we've been talking about a lot of 80s movies, so might as well have a 90s
movie. Yeah, man. And it's, once again, it's a little mean. It's a mean thing. The language is crude and rough. And, you know, I like the idea that the parents barely exist in it. And,
yes,
you know, like, it's just these kids kind of doing their thing. And it kind of started a whole idea of, you know, you're watching beautiful people in these movies. Like, that's the whole, you know, I know what you did last summer, and the 90s kind of, like, when just a bunch of faces on a movie poster were what sold it, not a cool picture of, like, you know, the killer. Like, So, yeah, but you cannot deny what it did. And the fact that they cranked out the three in a row pretty much almost a year after year after year. They were meta. They talked about horror, which was cool. Love them. Part three always used to get a lot of hate, and even for me at some points, but I think I could appreciate it for what it is now. I mean, you have Parker Posey in a movie, so that's always a good thing. Mm-hmm. And then the part four, I thought, was a great comeback when they did the most recent one. Once again, spawned a TV show. And yeah, I love it. Rose McGowan is amazing. It's sometimes when you watch those 90s movies, and I know some people probably have problems with Miramax, but when you watch these 90s movies, sometimes you just wonder, like, how many of these female actresses just had their careers ruined because of assholes like that? And it's not just that one Weinstein asshole, but like, you see all these promising people that like should have been huge stars. And it's like, you look on like an IMDb page and like, you wonder like, where all these women's careers stopped in like 2001, while the same, you know, Jamie Kennedy makes movies to this day. You know, it's a very, it's a bummer when you think about that, and just how that's just, you know, unfortunately, hopefully things are changing in this world. But when you see stuff like that, it's a harsh reminder of like, all these people just got screwed because they wouldn't fuck some asshole to get a better role. That shit ain't happening to Jamie Kennedy and, you know, Skeet Ulrich, you know, so, but that's, sorry, it's not really what we're talking about.
I love the shit.
No, that's okay. Sometimes every now and then somebody goes on a, you know, goes on a rant like that, so.
Sorry. Yeah.
That's fine. Tim, I know you had Scream as an honorable mention.
I did, and it came very close to making my list. It was sort of like, well, am I going to do this slasher or this slasher sort of thing? So I was just like, yeah, whatever. But yeah, totally, totally worthy entry. And you're right. It definitely, as Rocco said, it established that blueprint of, okay, when we do this type of movie now, unlike the old versions that are sort of scuzzy, kind of sleazy, this, it has to have actual like movie stars in it, or people who look like movie stars, even if they aren't big names yet. Like, that's who we want to see get killed now. So and when you think about it, that's how they do these things today. Look at all the like Saw movies, where I'm not saying those have like the biggest stars in the world in them, but there's definitely that element that takes you out of it a little, of okay, like the victims in this, as sympathetic as they might come across as characters, they still don't totally look like just normal everyday people. They look like movie stars, right? And I think that really does all tie back to Scream, and just sort of the, like, you had to have that glamour sheen thrown on top of it, and but that's what makes Scream work, you know. Like, they take it a little too far in other movies, I think, where, you know, they don't necessarily benefit from that aspect. But in Scream, it just enhances all of the things that you're not expecting to see that are really graphic and brutal in that movie. And I think the, you know, the sequels all have something going for them in their own right. Aren't they about to do even a fifth one pretty soon, I want to say?
I think it's done.
Is it done? Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So
I didn't know that.
Think about the Drew Barrymore kill.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people did not expect that. She was on the poster. She doesn't even make it to the credits. It's very impressive. Very
grisly.
Little nod to Psycho there, but like, even like doing it harsher, and it's a brutal scene.
Yes.
And and the idea of two killers is not something you get in a lot of horror movies. I know, like, Just Before Dawn is a 70s slasher that has two twin brothers in the woods killing people. But I don't know. I can't really think of any. I mean, of course, since it's a little Shyamalan twisty, where now they have to have two killers at the end of every one. And there's some, you know, at the each Scream has that, which, you know, you need that. They kind of maybe, you know, once again, studio notes can, you know, God only knows what happens behind the scenes and how these things go. It's scary to do something different. But, I mean, the worst thing you could say about Scream movies is that they really helped Creed become even more popular than the WWE did, I think. So,
quite possibly, yes.
A lot of Creed.
Yeah, and I mean, talking about the wrestling time, it's one of the few franchises that could say they had an actor in it that would become a WCW champion. So, I mean, you got David Arquette. So, all right. So I have one entry left on my list, and was mentioned very briefly, but it is the Saw franchise. And it was a very interesting franchise because when the first movie came out, that got like a lot of buzz because it was more, felt more like a psychological thriller. You know, these two guys locked in this bathroom and, you know, there's with a hacksaw, and it's basically like, you know, they both have different things they have to do or else, you know, they're going to die. And then of course, you know, again, talk about big twist, you know, the killer was in there the whole time. And then eventually as like the series went on, it felt more like it devolved from that into more just a matter of how many gruesome ways can we figure out how to kill people, because they came up with some really nasty stuff. And I remember I was working in movie theaters when like the more recent films, like, you know, four through like the final one at the time came out. And I always hated whenever I was ushering, I was having to do theater checks going into like a soft showing. And I tried to always go in where there wasn't a killing going on just because I could never enjoy that. So and then, of course, you had, the Jigsaw film from a few years ago. And then actually you had the newer one earlier this year with Chris Rock that kind of fell kind of a bit under the radar. But I think when you're talking about more modern horror, it seems like they've because we were talking about how some of those earlier like from the 70s and 80s didn't feature a lot of blood and gore. You get to like the 2000s where it's like almost every horror film had to have blood and gore, because you had like this, you had Final Destination and other films that came out that just were so heavily emphasized on just showing all these brutal killings. And I think Saw was definitely one of the ones that kind of paved the way for that. So, Tim, I know you had that as an honorable mention.
I do. And here again, as far as these more modern installments go, I think it's entirely valid. I just go back to that first Saw, which was, 2004? Five? I think four.
Yeah, I think it was 2004, yeah.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater with like a group of friends on opening night, which I want to say was Halloween night. And I can just remember the all the previews, the trailers at the time almost made it seem like a modern day Grindhouse movie, which it's not. But I think that marketing was pretty effective still, and I remember that being like a really fun, really tense theater experience, and I really liked that first one. And then they would do a sequel each year, like clockwork. It sort of became a new tradition where you could look forward to, if you were into those movies, you got however many before they did, you know, like you said, Jigsaw and then Spiral. So I mean,
and they put them out every Halloween too.
And it was like every Halloween. Yeah. Like you knew what time of year you were going to look forward to a Saw movie, to the point that other horror movies in October would kind of avoid it. Like they would give quite a bit of latitude to a Saw release just because they knew that was going to dominate the box office. So pretty momentous franchise. Wouldn't call it a personal favorite, but I've also never really like sat down and watched all of them. I know I've seen at least the first three, but I'm pretty sure like some of those later entries, I haven't even seen, might be worth checking out. If I ever find the time, but, I had a feeling Saw might make somebody's list.
I was never the biggest fan, but as I read more, I'm like, wow, they seem to have crazy plots, and like they seem to be very, they don't just try to do like a one-off, like each one ties back to the other ones and his wife. And, you know, you get to see Ashley Lawrence from Hellraiser looking amazing and being really
she
cool
does
in those.
Look amazing.
And, right. And Shawnee Smith, I think, is really good in those movies. So, and you get Luke from the Gilmore Girls being a cop and getting killed. So all good things. Not the biggest fan of them, but, they have a huge following, man. And they, like you said, they were staples. They were, you couldn't have, like, that was, that was horror. That was out. I mean, probably the of, you know, anything popular spawns garbage. Probably the worst genre ever is spawned from Saw, but obviously was not intended that way. Like you said, the first one is like a low budget indie kind of gritty crime movie with Danny Glover running around like a maniac trying to solve the case. Like one take Glover, I think, might have been his thing there because he was making some interesting choices. But yeah, and then it kind of just became kind of got away. But I mean, shit, that dude. Well, the guy who just did Malignant, like, that's a pretty goddamn, you know, the guy wound up doing
James Wan,
Furious movies and, you know, created Conjuring. Like, that's a good pedigree that guy has. And I loved Malignant, by the way. But yeah, not the greatest Saw fan, but definitely deserves to be on.
I just watched Malignant two nights ago. That's a wild fucking movie.
Hell yeah, man.
All right, well, that concludes all the lists, so let's hit the honorable mentions. I didn't have a lot. I had Halloween on mine. Just didn't quite make the list. Maybe could have bumped, you know, that in Saw, but I wanted to kind of add something modern on here. Mentioned it earlier, Final Destination. Again, just kind of another example of just finding newer ways to kill people, just with all the different gory, you know, deaths you see on there.
Possibly the best last movie of a franchise, too, I think. Like, if you think about how the last one's usually not really that great, I think the last Final Destination might be the best, well, probably the second best of the series, and also one of the best last movies of any franchise.
Yeah,
I would say that. Another kind of modern franchise, Paranormal Activity. Definitely, you know, that I remember that first one came out with so much hype and so much buzz, and it just really over delivered, and eventually, you know, spawned a franchise. Unfortunately, I think it got kind of hit the same problem that like Saw would have with franchise fatigue by the end, because they were like pumping them out every year, and it was just, you know, kind of tiresome. So, but still, you know, they made a lot of money, so they definitely deserve a mention. Also, it was briefly mentioned the Conjuring. So you have like those films, you have the Annabelle films, the Nun, kind of more modern films that do very well. I have to also mention the Alien franchise. You know, those were some pretty, you know, really good films throughout the 80s and 90s, made Sigourney Weaver a big star. And then you have the more recent ones, Prometheus and and those ones, too, that kind of helped rejuvenate that franchise. And then finally, I had Child's Play. So obviously, you know, we briefly mentioned Chucky in the icons. And you got to mention, obviously, the Child's Play films and the spinoffs from that one. And, you know, you had the reboot from last year, for 2 years ago, that, you know, kind of was a hit or miss one. So, but those were just some of the ones that I had. Tim, do you want to go ahead and give us some of your honorable mentions? I know you have a bunch of them.
I think Child's Play has one of the most consistent narratives of a slasher, because they really did keep the same story going with the same characters, and, you know, very rare to do that.
Yeah, definitely. Which is crazy, because it's like I know I've seen the first like three Child's Play movies, and then I kind of lose track of the franchise after that. But I know they kept it going, you know, several films deep now, and it's still sort of the same mythology, right? So
yeah, and the kid from the first one is in the most recent one that came out, Cult of Chucky, and they bring like the girl from 90210, Christina Lise. She was in part two, I think, and she comes back in this and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like they really.
They
like,
just got to get the mom together from Seventh Heaven back, and we're in business. So the only ones, let's see, that you didn't mention, Steve, I've got Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Predator, if you want to get into like sci-fi horror.
And then you have Alien versus Predator. Talk about another
Alien versus Predator.
Crossover.
You get a crossover, yep. Rocco kind of reminded me. The Fly is a franchise, you know, going back to, you know, like the 50s and 60s series of films, which get kind of increasingly bonkers. And then, of course, Cronenberg's remake in the 80s and the sequel to that in 89, which Rocco has... probably his mind is overflowing with more than has ever been said about The Fly after, again, one of our side conversations. Hellraiser, I'm surprised didn't come up. which is like 2.5 good movies, and then the rest are like just direct to video dreck. But it seems like they've got a remake coming somewhat soon next year to Hulu. I'm seeing
with a female Pinhead.
Yeah, female Pinhead. I'm kind of down for that. Depending on what the story is. How about The Evil Dead? Get in some horror comedy a little bit.
Great series, too. Great TV show.
Yeah. Well, and Ash could go on the icons list, too.
Yes. What
else here? Hannibal. So, you know, you got Silence of the Lambs, which, again, similar to Jaws, if you don't think it's a horror movie, you're just a snob. You know, the
one of the few horror films to win Best Picture, too.
Right, exactly. The sequel, Hannibal, which, and we get, you know, kind of two versions of Red Dragon. So I think four films a franchise makes, series as well, of course.
I mean, Manhunter is an incredible film.
Manhunter is so cool. Yeah. Candyman, you don't think of as necessarily being a franchise, but I would count anything that has at least three films a franchise, which Candyman does. So let's see.
From Virginia Madsen to Donald DeRico in three movies.
Yeah.
You have a Baywatch girl starring at the end. You go from Oscar nominee Virginia Madsen in the first one to Donald DeRico.
I feel like we've made stranger transitions in some of these, but let's see. We talked about The Conjuring. What about Insidious and Sinister, which are, I will never in my life be able to tell you if one is just on and I didn't put the movie on, I won't tell you whether it's an Insidious or a Sinister movie. They just, the names just overlap so much, even though I know they're completely different movies. But those, as far as like modern horror films, they have their moments. And, lastly, I have It. So you take the 90s TV movie and the two installments of, the remake, which honestly, I'm not really fond of, but I know people are. It made a shitload of money. So
oh yeah, it did.
Put it down as a franchise.
I mean, really, you can, I mean, if you're talking you know, flexibility with universes, you know, any Stephen King film could be could be a part of its own like universe, because they're like also like not outrightly connected, but there's like it's all very subtle in terms of the connections that they have. So yeah, I think that's definitely a good pick. Rocco, do you have any honorable mentions that we haven't talked about?
Sure. Speaking of Stephen King, and Cujo is in Cat's Eye in the beginning. So, yeah, there's a lot of crossovers.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's the dog.
I need to see Cat's Eye again, because that's one of the early, early anthology horror movies I saw, and I don't think I've ever seen it since. Like,
I love it. Some great.
Yeah, I got to go back
Robert
to
Hayes and Drew Barrymore and Cat versus Troll, very Trilogy of Terror kind of Zuni doll.
That
kind of
scene. That scene was burned into my mind for the longest time. It was one of those, like, I saw the scene when I was so young, like I barely even had, you know, object permanence, but somehow this scene was just stuck with me. And I was like, what is that from? What, I know it's some movie, you know, from the 80s, but I have no idea what the, and finally I figured out, oh, it's, you know, the Stephen King gimmick. And, you know, I don't know that I've seen it since, but
definitely worth watching. Directed, yeah, good shit, man. Louis Teague, the guy who did Alligator, very good.
Oh wow, yeah, I love Alligator.
Yeah, Robert Forrester's hair versus an alligator. I think you got to go Phantasm too, as
ooh,
well for that. I mean, the first one's so good, and Prophecy with Christopher Walken, I really thought was a cool '90s kind of vibe. They once again had the dimension, millions of sequels that went to DVD. The one that was the closest to making my list that didn't was Creepshow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Creepshow 1, 2, not that bullshit 3-1, but Tales from the Dark Side was supposed to be Creepshow 3, but there was like rights issues. So if you take those three, I would love to do a Making Mount Rushmore of creating the greatest horror anthology, where we each pick one of four different stories and make the best anthology. That would be incredible.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
Ghoulies. I'm a big fan of Ghoulies. If you're gonna say Gremlins as well, if there's two, The Howling, just for the fact they had so many, and parts 1, 2, and 3 are wild. Blair Witch, if you count 1 and 2, I think 2 is an underrated film, and if you could even count that weird Sci-Fi Channel thing they did when they were like the like little behind the scenes thing. I mean, this, if King Kong counts as horror, you know, geez, that's a lot of good horror right there. Yeah, I think that The Blob, maybe, because I think the original and the remake are both incredible movies.
Yeah. Wasn't there even one from like the 70s? I want to say.
Directed by Larry Hagman.
Larry Hagman. Yeah. What is he doing directing a Blob sequel? What?
Probably smoking weed and drinking a lot of cigarettes. Swamp Thing, which might be.
Okay. Yep.
I, you know, Heather Locklear in part 2.
Heather Locklear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Adrienne Barbeau showing some
PG nudity.
Mm-hmm. PG very, very explicit nudity for PG.
Yeah. Plus, had a great cartoon where they did the song "Swamp Thing" set to John Moxley's theme of "Wild Thing." I don't know if you guys have ever seen the Blind Dead movies from Spain, where there's like Templar knights that come back from the dead. They're very cool. Oh, a lot of zombies on horseback in slow motion, going through like the Spanish countryside. The Extro films I like a lot. Toxie, of course, Tox Avenger. And then you want to go Scanners, maybe, with Scanners and Scanners Cop and staples of HBO late nights with stuff like that. But yeah, I think Creepshow.
You a fan of Critters? You mentioned Ghoulies.
Yes, I should have said Critters. Critters 1, 2, and are definite classics, I think. 3 and 4 are both good as well. And if all the movies that go to space, it makes the most sense since they are from space. So, there
you go. Right, yeah. You know what does not... Sorry. It occurred to me a dishonorable mention would be... I feel like The Exorcist. Because... One stone cold classic, right? And a part 3 that a lot of people like, has its moments. And then kind of the rest of those are dog shit.
Oh, yeah, definite. Kind of a similar with Aim would be like Piranha, which has a classic and then a shit sequel. But then, like we were saying, one of the most mid-2000s movies ever, Piranha, the remake, 3D. Which is just like, it is literally like WWE 2005 era as a shark attack movie. It's just boobs, ridiculous language, gore. It's just summed up in one movie right there. And Eli Roth as a Joe Francis-esque character.
Yeah.
So pretty much everything you'd get watching WWE in that time period. And yeah, I mean, I think those would be some of my my big ones that would be on there. Prom Night, maybe too. I think a Prom Night.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Has some really interesting sequels.
Oh, you know, what about The Omen?
Ooh,
which I just thought of. And then, like, again, dishonorable, but probably like Children of the Corn, which is sort of maybe good movie.
And then how do you guys feel about the Poltergeist sequels?
Oh, Poltergeist. I think the second one's kind of okay, right?
That's because the first Poltergeist has become another like hangout movie where I just like the
characters.
I just want to be around those characters, and I don't even really need all that other shit to happen. Slumber Party Massacre 1, 2, and 3 are also all very good, all female directors with different takes and different styles to each movie. So I would put those on there as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, we can go. I mean, you can really go all night.
We just name every movie with a I almost said with Tremors, a sequel. But with a sequel. Yeah.
Oh man, Tremors. Yeah.
Speaking of Jamie Kennedy working.
All right. Well, Well, guys, that was a lot of fun. Talked on some great stuff there, and I think we pretty much covered almost everything we could in terms of the world of horror. So why don't we go ahead and wrap it up here. Rocco, where can everyone find you on social media, and what do you got going on in terms of other podcasts that you might be on?
I don't know if I'm going to ever be on a podcast again. I'm just waiting for people to ask me, and I'll do it. But hopefully I'm not as annoying as my girlfriend, my wife, and I think I am. But other people might like it.
Yeah, they'll be coming up to you in the airports in no time.
Yeah,
I think my wife finds me amusing as well. Yeah, I mean, you can look me up on Instagram. I have an Instagram account. I have a band, Chained to the Dead. It's a extreme metal band that we have a lot of songs about horror movies. So fittingly enough, songs about, I don't know, Michael Berryman and The Pit, my all-time favorite movie, and Society and Slugs and Pieces, The Gate. I think there was a Sleepaway Camp song. There was a song about Critters, now that you mentioned it, which is funny. I didn't bring it up. Mm. But yeah. That's Chained to the Dead. You can find that at bandcamp.com. You can listen to all our shit and buy some stuff if you care. And that is also has an Instagram page, which you could follow. And I'm currently posting some VHS tapes for the month of October, if you like looking at VHS boxes. But that's it.
Wow. All
right. What about you, Tim?
Okay. So Rocco and I... did a podcast together. Rocco was a guest on 9021 NOSO, which is a show you can find on our sister feed, the North-South Connection. So it's a regular show that JT Rosero and I do, going chronologically through all of the episodes of the original, Beverly Hills 90210. Pretty new podcast, so we're only about 8 episodes deep into that. But Rocco was on a very recent installment with us, talking some of the greatness, the tour de force of Anne Gillespie's performance as Jackie Taylor in that first season. Real standout episode. Got a couple more episodes coming your way pretty soon, if not available already. So check that out if you're a 90210 fan on the North-South Connection.
It's a great show. I listened to it, but Tim and Justin have an incredible chemistry. And even if you don't like the show, you'll like it.
That's what we like to hear. So, and if you, you know, do like the show or even hate the show, honestly, and want to be a guest at some point, reach out to us. We definitely need bodies, need guests, because there's just shy of 300 episodes of this series we have to cover at some point. Fingers crossed. So we will definitely have some repeat guests. We'll have all kinds of folks. Definitely not hard to get yourself booked. Got a few slots left open, I think, for season one. But, you know, season two wide open. And
I'm going to make a horror movie where I start killing off all the announced guests so I can just be on the show as the third host.
So you can just be our third man. Yeah.
Yep.
Permanently. That's a good high concept horror movie. I like it.
The Guinea killer. Killing for Dylan.
Love it. worst motives for sure. Also, our other sister affiliate is the Jenny Position. This is curated by Jennifer Smith, and I do a few podcasts over there with her, most notably Talkin' Pop. So myself and Jenny did a Halloween special, which is kind of a first for us, a real loaded episode of our podcast together, Talkin' Pop. And we watched, and I use the term loosely, watched Arachnophobia, mostly had it on in the background as we did other things, and then freaked out at key moments in the film. But it's great to set the mood. We ranked our favorite Halloween-ish, Halloween-themed movies. We talked about some local folklore, some really goofy stuff in there. Our favorite Halloween traditions, memories, costumes over the years, and plans for this year. So if you want to get into the spirit of the season, do check out that Talkin' Pop with me and Jenny over on the Jenny Position. Now, Jenny is also revived for this season and continuing on, as I understand, after Freak Out Drive-In. This is her horror-themed podcast. She's going to be dropping an episode each Friday throughout the month of October. I was on the returning edition of that, talking Hellraiser with Jenny. So live watch there. We had a great time, great movie. And she's had a couple of guests since then. If you want to get booked for Freak Out Drive-In, you know, whether it's an episode this month or future installments where it's probably going to be more of a monthly show, just reach out to Jenny. I know she's trying to get guests lined up for that, and looking forward to some more horror live watches. You can find me on social media. I am at Cyke68, C-Y-K-E-68 on Twitter. So go ahead and reach out. You can DM me if you want to get in touch for anything podcast related or just to shoot the shit. So yeah, that'll do it for me.
All right. And you can usually find me here on the Pop Experience. I, of course, am now the new moderator host of this show. And of course, I also am part of Pop Goes to Classics along with Andy Atherton and Miranda Berthold. We are currently going through all of the Disney animated films. Taking a little bit of a brief hiatus. We just did The Rescuers last month. So we should hopefully be back in November with The Fox and the Hound. So we're closing in very quickly on the Disney Renaissance. So we got a couple of big heavyweights coming here in the coming months and as we get into 2022. You can usually find me on Facebook. I'm part of the Place to Be Facebook page. Lots of great stuff going on over there. Great discussions. You know, we have questions of the day. And we have a great tournament going on. Speaking of 90210, we are currently determining the greatest TV drama of all time, covering pretty much the entire, you know, We're talking stuff from like the 50s and 60s all the way up to today. We've had a lot of heavy hitters already come up. We've got more coming. So get over to the Place to Be Facebook page, ask to be included in the group, and you can join in and vote in determining what the greatest TV drama will be. So we got that going on. So, all right. So we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. We will be back next month. As it was mentioned in the last episode, we will now be going monthly instead of biweekly. So we will be looking forward to what we got going on next month. So for Rocco Martone and Tim Capel, I am Steve Riddle. This has been Mickey Mount Rushmore, and we will see you next time.